Now it's working. Good. Okay, then. Okay, then I'll have something to do in break. Should be a different one. I'm not presenting the same presentation twice, of course. Could do. No, apologies for that. So I will make some corrections. No, today we'll talk about biometrics, so not authentication in general, and this will go a bit further than what can be found in the book. And the reason I'll go a bit deeper into biometrics is because that is one of the courses that you will have if you choose the technology track, and because I know a bit about it. So biometrics. Go here. Here is a definition of biometrics. If you Google for that, you can find probably many definitions. Here is one. In biometrics, we use automated methods to recognize or verify the identity of a living person based on biological or behavioral characteristics. So there's a lot of words that are in bold. No idea where. Oh, there's my mouse. So first of all, automated. Automated means that I am not recognizing your face or your voice. Automated means that a machine should be able to do something. It says recognize and verify, or verify. Recognize actually is what we call identification. So establishing the identity of a person. Verify means authentication, verifying a claimed identity. Note that identification and authentication are slightly different used than what is used in the book for authentication. The identification process is there being presenting an identifier. So typing your username, that's called identification. And then authentication or verification is actually checking that with the password. In biometrics, authentication means that you claim an identity and that I verify that based on a biometric characteristics like a fingerprint. Identification means that I just get the biometric information and from that I establish your identity. So it's a slightly different use of terminology. A living person. Living means that there is not a body lying here and trying to figure out who that is. It's not forensics. And person is singular. So I'm trying to identify a single person. Not a group of persons or anything. Yeah, a single living person. And then biological and behavioral, I think I explained them last week already. Biological is physical characteristics of our body. Fingerprint, face, iris. Behavioral is things that we learn to do in a particular way. Speaking, so voice, the way that we walk, gait, the way that we write a signature, the way that we type on a keyboard, these kinds of things. So that's one definition that you can find. If you look a bit further, there is the International Standard Organization that also has a definition which fits authentication more than identification, but it says automated, again, recognition of individuals based on their behavioral and biological characteristics. So more or less all the same elements are there. Automated, it's recognition, it's a person, a single person, and behavioral or biological. Behavioral, this is also a way of describing this. Behavioral has to do with the function of the body, while biological biometrics has to do with the structure of the body. If you define it actually as on the previous slide, learn behavior, then what would your ECG fall under? It's not a physical characteristic. It's not something that I learned. I didn't learn how to beat my heart. But it has to do with the function of the body. So in this case, the definition is a bit more broad. In biometrics, we have a certain terminology that can easily be misused. So the ISO committee came up with a what is called harmonized biometric vocabulary, which can be found on the website of Christoph Busch, who is also here in working on biometrics. And so if you go to this particular website, you will see all the terminologies that we are using nowadays, should be using nowadays. Very briefly, something on the history of biometrics. Biometrics is not something new. Biometrics is something that is, in fact, very old already. Not the automated systems, but the idea behind biometrics. Actually, it dates back to ancient Egypt, where there was fingerprints in a clay pot or whatever, so that you could see the owner of that particular device. Before modern biometrics started with fingerprint recognition, because fingerprints and criminals, that was one thing, and so there were policemen and actually a Belgian mathematician who actually discovered in the late 1800s that there were differences in fingerprints of different people and that could be used. There was a Czech person studying, actually discovering that sweat glands could be seen and could be distinguishable feature between persons. They started with taking inked fingerprints. Now we have these scanners where you put your finger on, and now before you had to make an inked, put ink on your fingerprint and have this, what is called a rolled print, where you roll the full finger over it, over a paper. There is a system that actually started with a general description of a fingerprint. Yeah, if you look at a fingerprint, I can detect some global features of that. And then if I say that, okay, this fingerprint has this global feature and this, yeah, and I describe that for all 10 fingers, I can do some rough classification. In the 1880s, actually the modern fingerprint recognition and face recognition started. Obviously, if you say automated, that means a machine is doing this. That was not happening in the 1880s. But it was a different than, hey, I see your face and I recognize that face. They were taking measurements of faces, of fingerprints, classifications of fingerprints and faces, and based on that, an identification or authentication took place. Much newer, speaker and fingerprint recognition, where actually computers were used. You can't do speaker. You can indeed listen to the sound of somebody and say, "I know this person. I can authenticate or identify this person." But then you're not really measuring. Yeah. So for really measuring voice, you need a computer. So speaker and fingerprint recognition, where computers were used, started in the 1960s. Hand geometry, so the shape of the hand, was used, was introduced in the 70s. Then face verification, which was also a standard way of recognizing people, in the 1980s, but also retinal, which is special because it's not visible from the outside. It's not observable from the outside. You have to look at the back of the eye to find the retina. And signature, which is actually the first behavioral biometrics that was introduced in the 1980s. Investigated. Iris recognition in the 1990s by John Dorman. Unfortunately, he took a patent on its method. The method was perfect, but he took a patent and nobody wanted to pay. And so for a long time, that was not really used. And then more recent, more focus also on behavioral biometrics, gait, keystroke dynamics, etc., brain waves, these kinds of things. Let's look at authentication versus identification, because there are differences between that. Often in the methods that are used, in the specifics, there's not a big difference, but yeah, there are some essential differences there. First of all, as said, authentication is verifying a claimed identity. I am Patrick, here's my fingerprint, now you can check that I'm indeed Patrick. Establishing an identity, that's identification. My mother calling me on the phone and saying, hey, it's me. And I recognize the voice. And though me is not a real identity, I recognize the voice and I established that it is her. So here the question is this the person who he or she claims to be? That's the thing that we want to answer. And it's a one against one verification. I have a database with a lot of people in it, but I know what person I have to look at, and I look at the characteristics of that person in the database, and I check it against the characteristic that that person is giving me, one to one. In identification, the question is, who is this person? And because I don't know who that person is, I look at my database, and all of these persons in there, all of these characteristics, for each person, I compare the characteristics to the characteristics of the person I try to identify, and I'll see which one matches best. But the way I do the matching here, and the way I do the matching here, in principle, that's the same technique, except that I have to do it many times here and just one time here. Yeah? Password is authentication, yes. Yes. Yeah? You claim an identity, your username is your identity, your electronic identity, and your password is your proof that, hey, that is me because I know the secret connected to this identity. No, in the book, they define identification as the process of providing your identity. That's completely different from this identification. Yeah. So these two terms, although it's the same word, have a completely different meaning. Yeah, so in terms of following the book on passwords and tokens, identification is saying, hey, this is me, that's all. No proof or whatever, just providing the identity. In biometrics, identification is really finding out who it is based on some kind of information. He's actually not providing an identity here. I'll figure out what the identity is. Then there is something which is called... There's something called positive and negative recognition. So what's that? Two different things again. Positive recognition is to prevent multiple people from using the same identity, and negative recognition is the opposite, preventing one person from using multiple identities. So it looks like they are connected, but there is a significant difference there. Here, it means that nobody else can claim to be me. You can't give biometric proof that you are me. You can't give my fingerprint to prove that it's me. Here it's that I can't be somebody else. If the biometric proof points to me, I can say, no, that's not me, it's somebody else. No, it points to me. Positive recognition I can do with a password or a token also. Yeah? Nobody knows my password, so nobody else can act like me. I can't do that with negative recognition. I can't prove that I don't know a password or I don't have a token. Yeah, so negative recognition is only possible with biometrics, and it's often used in forensics. There is a fingerprint on a crime scene, and if that's my fingerprint, then I was in that room. That's my DNA on a crime scene, that is me. Let's see if we can get some examples of biological and behavioral biometrics. As said, something to do with the physical appearance and something to do with the function of the body. I'll give you a few already. Fingerprint, face, and iris obviously are biological biometrics. And behavioral biometrics, voice and signature. Let me give you a few more. These are the ones that everybody knows about, right? No surprise, I hope, here. Retina, so the back of the eye, it's obviously a biological biometric. Hand shape, that's a biological one. It's a physiological characteristic. Gait, the way that we walk, that's a function of the body or something that we learn to do. Keystroke dynamics, that we type on the way that we type on a keyboard. That is something that we learn to do again. So behavioral biometric, the function of the body. So what more? Can you come up with a biometric characteristic? There's one. DNA. In what? Okay, so we have... This is biological, and this is behavioral. So we say DNA. Okay, very good. Yeah, which one? Yeah, so veins. Brainwaves, where? Yeah, the function of the body, exactly. There are many more. See, there's a lot of room here, so. Color of the eye? Probably not, right? I have brown eyes, other people will have brown eyes, so that will be hard, yeah? Yeah? One more. Often used, by the way, in forensics. What more? We'll see if we can find a few more. Mouse dynamics. If I can look at the way somebody used the keyboard, I can also look at the way that he uses the mouse. Let's have a few biological ones. Let's see those first. Thermogram. Thermogram is take a picture of your face or your body, and it shows me how warm particular parts are. I can use that. In particular, when we look at identical twins, that will be difficult. But actually, if I take from identical twins a thermographic image of the face, those images will be different. Ear. I can look at the shape of my face, but I can also look at the shape of my ear. I will go into slightly more details afterwards also. Vein patterns, yeah, that was mentioned, very good. Odor. The way we smell. Dogs can follow a trace, right? So apparently there is something specific in the odor that they can follow that. Dental records, yeah, that was mentioned. DNA was also mentioned. And then some footprint. Hand could also be not just the shape of the hand, but the patterns that I have on my fingertip, I have on my full hand. And actually I have them on my feet also. I could do footprint also. Behavioral ones, email behavior. You get these emails from a particular person and you know that this person is from this email is from this person, and you know it will be a long email or a short email or to the point, or he will not have a solution at the beginning or a greeting at the end or something like that. These things are particular. The way that we write an email is very particular. The amount of emails could be particular. The way that we play games. Everybody has his own strategy. We often stick to that, specifically poker or something. The way that we interact with a keyboard. And not just how we, if we use the mouse or the keyboard to do particular actions, but also what kind of browser are you generally using. Yeah? I always use Google Chrome. How do you print the document? Do you click on this icon? Or do you type Ctrl P? Or do you do Alt F and then P? Something like that. The way that we interact with a GUI. Lip movement. So it's not really face recognition because I focus on the lips. It's not really voice because I'm not using that. But when I speak, my lips move. That is also very typical. Touchscreen interaction. Yeah, the way that I type on interact with a tablet or a phone. Yeah? And I do swipes there, which is in principle a mouse, or I tap on that, which is in principle the same as keystroke dynamics. I can do touchscreen interactions. Gestures, the way that I wave my hand. Or maybe draw a specific pattern on in the air, or maybe on a phone to unlock it. Car driving. The way that we drive a car. Let's go into a bit more detail of all of these. The brainwave. Brainwave wasn't there, but it is indeed a behavioral biometric. Blinking. The way that we blink our eyes. Yeah, I have a song in my head, And based on that song, I start blinking my eyes, and then I can actually look at blinks versus non-blinks if I sample at specific time interval, or I can look at the time between blinking or something like that. Actually, if you do that, you get these very disturbing pictures. At least when I saw it first, it was like, is this real? But yeah, somebody had a song in mind, and so it's if I translate it in bits, it is 0110010, etc. And if I have a song in my mind and I blink on that song, next time I want to authenticate, I'll have the same song in my mind and I'll do the same blinking and I will have a similar pattern. Probably you have to adjust maybe for small errors or something like that. Yeah, but if you don't know my song, it's hard to blink on that way. Car driving, as mentioned. How fast do we accelerate or decelerate? How are we taking turns? Is it very smooth or very rough or whatever? How do we? Maybe there are some sensors built in the pedals, and how much force do we apply to that, etc., etc. I was actually last year in a conference in Germany where I talked to somebody working at Mercedes, and they were really interesting in this concept. So if anybody wants a nice master thesis topic, come to me now, take the technology track, and I'm sure that I can arrange that you have your final thesis there. DNA is unique per person. Not completely, because if I get a transplant of a kidney, all of a sudden I have two DNAs in strands in me. But for all normal purposes, DNA is unique. Often used in negative recognition, so forensics applications. Ear recognition. So looking at where specific points of the ear are located, or taking measurements there. Actually, ear recognition is also used in forensics applications, because a thief will come to your house and he will listen on a window if somebody is home, if he hears something. And that will leave an imprint that could actually be lifted, same as a fingerprint. And that has actually been used in court cases. Face recognition, everybody knows face recognition. There are different techniques. There are 2D and 3D images I can take of a face, and then I can either identify a lot of these what is called landmark points and just look at the relation between them. Now this distance is a fixed parameter. Obviously, if I start using my mouth, I'll get some variation there, but the number of those are fixed. There is another that's difficult to see. Another technique called eigenfaces, where you see where actually I take a picture of a person and I don't build it up in pixels, but I build it up as a combination of images. So there are small rectangles here and a lot of them, and so any image I can build up as a linear combination of these. And depending on that linear combination, I can recognize the person. Fingerprints, we know that. If we look at a fingerprint, we see what is called ridges and valleys. So the dark ones are the ridges and the light ones are the valleys. And sometimes we see that let me see if I can find it somewhere very clear. I will have another picture somewhere. Sometimes one ridge is all of a sudden splitting in two. And that point where that happens is what's called a minutia, or a ridge is just ending somewhere. That's again called a minutia. So we have different types of minutia and we can use those. Gait, the way that we walk. Shakespeare, great Juno comes. I know her by her gait. So just by listening, somebody walking, we could recognize that Shakespeare knew that you could recognize a particular person. Yeah, we have that at home too. If one of my kids is running up the stairs or even going up the stairs, I can exactly tell which one it is. You hear that. We can either use a video to videotape somebody, so it's kind of surveillance. We can have a special surface where if I walk on the pressure is measured. What we do nowadays most here is wearable sensor based. So my mobile phone can measure acceleration. So when I have it in my pocket, he actually can measure if the way that I'm walking and compare that to my walking model. So gait recognition. Hand geometry, so what is the shape of my hand? So I have a number of pins in such a device so that the hand is in a standard position, and then I measure width of the fingers, length of the fingers, thickness of the hand, and I'll use these measurements. Iris recognition by John Dobbin. The iris is the colored part in the eye, so we have some white and we have the black pupil. But the colored part is divided in a number of rings, and then some characteristics of each of these rings is turned into a binary code called an iris code. So we can easily do that with humans. Actually, in India, they recognize cows by their iris. And if somebody is interested, I'm involved in a project. This is a Salmon, where they want to do iris recognition on Salmon. This is not a joke. That's a bit outside of the scope of this class, but these are called farm Salmons. So they should be in a particular container, and if they get out of that container, they could contaminate wild Salmon. And in order to identify later on that this Salmon actually came from that farm, they want to do iris recognition. If somebody has programming skills and is interested in earning a bit of money, this is a project that I have right here and now. I think it's interesting. We have software already available to do iris recognition here, but it has to be adjusted because an iris of a Salmon behaves differently. Keystroke dynamics, the way that we type on a keyboard, pressing down keys, releasing keys. We can actually listen to the sound of somebody typing and use that to identify him or authenticate him. When I type my password, I can then check if you type the correct password. I always do that. I can check how you type the password. In addition, you don't need to do anything extra. You get the biometrics for free. With a fingerprint, I have to go to a sensor and put my finger on the sensor. That's a specific activity that I have to do. Keystroke dynamics, I don't have to do anything. In fact, keystroke dynamics, once I'm logged on, if I would go now, and you would sit behind my computer sending an email to the dean or to the director, calling him all kinds of nasty names, that would be on my account, right? That's my email address. But you're using the keyboard. I can do keystroke dynamics also once I'm locked on. So not just to get access, but also continuously afterwards. And it can detect the difference between you and me in typing rapidly. 80 keystrokes, and then it has determined that, hey, this is not Patrick, and I will just lock. Yeah. Actually, you can also look at the heat transfer. So somebody was typing on this particular ATM keypad, and here we can see the thermogram of that, and we see that all of these keys are rather cold, except these two are a bit warm, and then these two are even warmer. And I personally can't really distinguish between these two or these two. So, but these two are pressed first, and these two are pressed last, because they are still the warmest. And if I look closely, I could maybe say, well, this was pressed first and then this one. And here I have to do a bit of guessing. But I can easily find back the pin code that somebody typed. Maybe I have to try a few times. 1-4 or 4-1 to start with, and 5-8 or 8-5 to end with. I have to do some guesses there. I can find back what somebody typed. Lip movement. So we're not just listening to exactly what somebody's saying, but we are looking at the way that the lips are moving. Mouse dynamics, how am I moving the mouse in what direction in general, what is the speed, how directly am I going from point A to point B, is it more or less a straight line or am I taking all kind of detours, how am I clicking speed, double clicking speeds, etc. Difficult to find a picture related to mouse dynamics, so I have this one. Then, yeah, odor. I think that's the funniest. So we can recognize people by the way that they smell. Yeah, dogs can do that. We can do that, actually. Yeah, there are some people that have a very specific smell. You recognize them by their smell. But it will be hard to have a sensor that opens the computer based on my smell. Again, finding pictures is quite difficult there, so I'm not sure if this is biometrics or something else, but I wouldn't volunteer there. Palm print, so not just fingerprint or hand shape, but actually considering that the full palm has the same characteristics as a fingerprint, but at much larger scale. See, this is a fingerprint, and this is a full hand. Obviously, I get much more information here. Much more noise, probably also, but I get much more information. And I just pick out the information which is clearest. Retina, it's inside the body, as I said before. So we have the eye with the iris here, and then the pupil, and then the light gets into the falls onto the retina, and then what they do is just take a ring at the back of the eye and look at the blood vessel pattern. So here is no blood vessel and there is a blood vessel, and then look at that particular pattern. Very unique pattern, very secure because nobody can see my iris pattern. So very good performance of this particular biometric. But there is a sensor, and you really have to put your eye close to the sensor. Not sure if you ever had been at the eye doctor and they had taken a picture of that, but it's kind of scary. Signature, the way that we write a signature. Either we look at just the shape, or if I have special equipment capturing the fingerprint, I can look also at the dynamics of writing it. So apparently this was the first stroke, and then I had another stroke, and then a third stroke, etc. What is the speed? What is maybe the pressure with which I press the pen on the tablet? And then something that is actually not biometrics, but it's called soft biometrics. In the beginning I said the color of the eye. And you all smile because, yeah, obviously that's not really distinguishable. Yeah? But if I know that I have a large group of people and I want to identify a person, yeah, that means that I have to look at the whole population, which is the black circle. But at some point I learned that actually this is a male. Okay, then I don't have to look at everybody anymore. I can look at a subset. Yeah, so if the biometric, if a fingerprint or a face could reveal that I'm a male, then I just have to look at a subset of that. And maybe the face image also reveals something about my age. Okay, and then I look in this subset that is 40 plus. But if I know that it's a male and he's 40 plus, yeah, then I just have to look at this small area. Yeah, so more or less soft biometrics is finding some characteristics of a person that are not distinguishable at a personal level, but that will help me shrink the group of people that I have to look at. Yeah, if I also know something else, then maybe that's that area where I have to look for the identification becomes much and much smaller. Remember, identification was one against many. My characteristics, and I have to look at everybody in this large black circle to find a match. And all of a sudden, I know something about that person, and I'm just going to look at a small subset. Voice is the last example that we have. It's also called speaker recognition. And there is a distinction, obviously, between speaker recognition and speech recognition. In speech recognition, I have a machine that understands what I am saying. And so based on that information, it can transfer my call or whatever, or it can give me information or whatever. Doesn't matter who it is. If I say a particular word, or you say that word, or you say that word, doesn't matter. If it's the same word, it should recognize the same, that particular word. Speaker recognition means that I can really pinpoint a person. Fixed or free text, sometimes I have to say my password, which is obviously not secret because everybody can hear me saying, yeah, open sesame, and then that particular text is recognized. And obviously a bit more difficult system in terms of analysis is when I can say whatever I want, and it still recognizes my particular features of my voice. Yeah, but obviously that's a more difficult task because it doesn't know what it is, what it can expect. It has to extract some global features. So those are some examples of biometrics, but why can we use voice as a biometrics? Why can we use fingerprint as a biometrics, as a way to identify or authenticate? Actually, there are 7 relevant biometric properties that we have to look at. Universality, distinctiveness, permanence, collectability, performance, acceptability, and circumvention. Let's see what it means. Universality. Each person should possess that particular biometric characteristics. So not just a subgroup, a small subgroup or whatever, everybody should have it. Or more or less everybody should have it. I mean, fingerprint, not everybody has a fingerprint. Yeah? If I don't have hands or arms, I don't have a fingerprint. And there are people without arms or hands. So that happens. I can't do iris recognition if, for some reason, my eyeballs are gone or something. Yeah, but generally over a large group of the population or the group that I'm interested in, the people working at this building, yeah, if they come in, they can present their fingerprints because everybody has a fingerprint. Distinctiveness. Different persons should have different biometric characteristics. My fingerprint is different from your fingerprint. And your fingerprint is different from her fingerprint. Everybody has a specific, unique fingerprint. Yeah? I should not be recognized as you. And so that means our biometric characteristics should be different. Permanence is that it should be invariant over a period of time. If I come today and give my fingerprint, and if I come tomorrow and I give my fingerprint again, that should be the same fingerprint. Can't change overnight, because then the system can't recognize me anymore. Could still be different between us, but it's different from myself. Yeah, so then it can't be recognized. So it should be invariable. So for example, the length of your hair, that's not a good feature. That will change quite rapidly. It could also change overnight if you cut it, but if we just grow it, then it will get longer only. Faces will change. We all grow older. We get wrinkles. We get whatever. Our face changes. Generally not at a rapid pace. The way I look today and the way I look tomorrow will be pretty much the same. I could get a scar. That could happen. Yeah? But then that probably means that maybe I have to renew some of my stored biometrics in the database. Generally, that doesn't happen. Collectability. Yeah, I want to do something automated, so obviously in some way I have to get that biometric characteristics in this machine to do the analysis. It should be accurate. I don't want it to make a lot of mistakes. Acceptable. Now fingerprint is more or less commonplace. But like 20 years ago, he said, here, I have this nice fingerprint system. And you can use that to get access. No, not interested. Fingerprints, that had to do with criminals, right? I don't want that. Now it's accepted because it's used much more. Like I said, retina recognition. I have to come very close with my eye to a sensor. And there is light actually transmitted into my eye. People might be afraid that might damage the eye. Maybe I make a wrong movement or a machine makes a wrong movement and damages my eye. So that's not a really accepted one. And then circumvention, if I can easily fool the system, if I can spoof a biological biometric or I can mimic a behavioral biometric very easily, yeah, then it doesn't really work. So let's look at a biometric system. A biometric system, in principle, contains two modules. First module is the enrollment module. You use that once. As I said, I have this database with all the information of the users, with all the biometric characteristics in there. But I have to put it in there. So I have to enroll. So I have to go to the administrator and I give my fingerprint, and he puts in the database my fingerprint and my identity. So the next time when I do the authentication, that's the other module, which I use over and over again, when I use that, I'll provide my identity again. It knows which fingerprint is mine in that database, and I'll give it again, and then it just checks if that is from the same person. Actually, the other module could also be the identification module in a similar way. Yeah, so enrollment we do once, and then we use the data that is stored in the database for authentication or for identification. And we can use that over and over again. And we have to enroll again, yeah, if all of a sudden something changes in our biometrics. Yeah, if I've grown 10 years older, I might want to change my face picture in the database for face recognition. Might not recognize me that well anymore. So here we have the same, but now in a bit more detail, we have the biometric characteristics, let's say a fingerprint, and we present it to a sensor, and that sensor will then capture, a sample of my fingerprint. So a captured biometric sample, but that could be a picture of my fingerprint. That picture is not used as is, of course. We extract features from that. Maybe some noise reduction or whatever, some processing on it, but at some point, features will be extracted. And then we have to distinguish if we are in the enrollment phase, I'll take that information and I'll store it in the database together with an identity. And if we are in the verification or identification phase, then these features will be compared to what I get from this database. In case of a verification, authentication, it's a one-to-one comparison. I provided my identity, my information is extracted, and is compared to what is captured here. If it's an identification, I'll just compare the new data to everything in the database. Yeah, and then, based on that comparison, I either, in case again of authentication, I have a match and or not. I give my fingerprint, I claim your identity, and I give my fingerprint, and I hopefully don't have a match. And I give my own identity, and I give my fingerprint, and hopefully I do have a match. And in terms of identification, we get this is the person, or maybe the system decides that, hey, actually I now saw a fingerprint and doesn't really look like any fingerprint that I know. So it's not looking just for the best one. The best one should also be good enough. Yeah, if I do face recognition, and I'll take a picture of the dean, yeah, and all our faces are in the database, then the database should not just say, oh, it's you because you look most to him. No, nobody really looks like him, even though you look most like him, but that's still a big difference. So this is this is, by the way, from the ISO standard. This is, in a small picture, the way that a biometric system works. How do we get these biometric features? Well, there are actually three origins of that. Part of it is what we get from our parents. We get our genes from our parents. And so based on that, we get particular characteristics. The shape of your face, very much related to your parents. And sometimes you see people say, oh yeah, that you're the son of this and this person. Yeah, I recognized your father and you have a similar face. Part of that is purely random. Yeah, in the fetal stage when the fetus is growing, some of these developments are just by random. You're not exactly like your father. You look like him, but not exactly. You're not a copy. Yeah? And some of these changes are purely random. And then conditional, that mostly has to do with the behavioral biometrics. You learn to do specific things in specific ways. Let's, before I go to a break, let's give an example. Fingerprint. As I said, the black one are the ridges and the white parts are the valleys. And so we look at where there is a ridge, which splits here into two parts. Here is another one. Here's the ridge. Actually, that splits here already. And then here splits again. So this is what we call a bifurcation. There's another one. You're going to look. There's one. You can identify many. There's one. So there's a number of bifurcations that we can identify. And there is ridge endings. So this particular ridge is stopping here. This particular ridge stopping here. You can find many more. This gap between two ridges, that can be either a real gap, or that could be just an error, noise in the capturing process. So there are algorithms to determine, hey, is this here? Is there a ridge ending here and a ridge ending there, or is this probably an error in the capturing process, and this should be just a simple ridge? Also here, maybe this one connects, and it's not a ridge ending but a ridge bifurcation. There are algorithms to do that kind of analysis, so we'll not go into that. And I'll have a fingerprint. My fingerprint is captured. The ridge endings and ridge bifurcations, so the features, also here a singularity that has to do with this global shape. So that's dating back to the old days of the start of fingerprint recognition. So all of this information, that are the features, that is stored in the database together with my identity. Then if I try to authenticate, I get this reference image from the database, and I get this probe image, it's called, which is the one I just gave to get authenticated. And you see a lot of differences. Difference in size, different in, let me see here, you have that singularity which is there. And so you see this area is about this area, so there is some extra here. Maybe it's a bit, I can't really see it, maybe it's a bit turned or whatever. Maybe there's a bit more pressure on one, this is more dark, this is lighter. So there are differences there. But still, if you would see those, would you think that this is from the same person? Now you see this global shape here, that's the same, so the singularity is the same, and then probably if you go look at here is a singularity also. So ridges are going like this, and the ridges going like this, so this is called a delta. I see that here too. And they are, in terms of location of the two singularities, that could really match. And then if you look at details, you could really find a match. But what we do, of course, is we go and look at these we identify these singularities, and we identify a number of ridge bifurcations there and ridge endings. I don't see where, but probably ridge endings also. And I do that for the reference and for the probe image. I have done it for the reference image already, but just for illustration, I show the process together. And then what we'll do is we'll forget about the image. I don't need the image anymore. I just need these features. I have to compare those. Well, if I overlay them, if I put the two singularities at the same location, and I'll see what happens to the blue and the green features. I see that, here I got a pretty good match. Here also, there's, some of them are far apart. Doesn't mean that this here is also green underneath. These are a bit further apart, but this could actually be a different feature than this. Or it could be the same feature where there is, due to the alignment at a slightly different location. Anyway, we see that this probably is from the same person. These values are close together. Somehow I have to define how similar the blue features and the green features are. And if they're very similar, I can say it's the same person. If they're not similar, I should say it's a different person.
If you have several different fingerprint hardware,
So the question was, what if I have different hardware? We have done tests with 5 sensors, and we captured all 10 fingers on all 6 sensors, by the way. On all 6 sensors, we captured all 10 fingerprints, and we captured each fingerprint on each sensor 10 times for 100 persons. So we had a huge database, 72,000 images. 12 times we captured each fingerprint, 72,000 images. And it didn't matter if we just took the data of one sensor and did the comparison, or we took two different sensors and had the cross-sensor comparison. Doesn't matter. Obviously, you have to look at the specifics of a sensor. If one sensor is measuring at 500 dpi and the other at 1,000 dpi, yeah, then you have to compensate for that. Yeah, but that's an easy thing to do. Unfortunately, there are errors. If we have a password and you want to use a username and password to get access, that's 100% correct or 100% wrong. There's not a single system that says, oh, he typed the password, but yeah, see that he used a capital instead of a small letter, but it's so close. Let's let him in. No system does that. Token, it's either 100% genuine or 100% false. Again, no system will say, I see some errors on the token, but let's just accept that. If I take my Unsorted card and I put it in the ATM machine, the ATM machine will say, this is not a banking card. You know, it doesn't say, oh, when I look at the picture, it's still Patrick. Yeah, that's okay. 100% wrong or 100% correct. And biometrics. If I present my fingerprint on a fingerprint scanner twice, it will never be exactly the same. If I take a picture of my face twice, it will never be 100% the same picture. I turn my finger a bit, I have a bit more pressure, I shift it a bit up and down, left or right, slightly different. It's maybe one day it's very dry and I get a very pale image, one day it's a bit wetter and I get a dark image. Never exactly the same. So the only thing that I can do in biometrics, I don't have 100% certainty. I can only make a conclusion, this is most likely the same person, or this is most likely a different person. That's the only thing that I can say. And because of that, I make errors. Because if I could do it with 100% certainty, I wouldn't make errors. Let me see. I think this is a nice point where I thought to have a break. Yeah. So know that we can make errors. And what I will go on in the second half of this class is actually how we can do comparison and what kind of errors we get and what the quality of a biometric system is. Any questions so far? Anybody interested in either the car behavior or the fish? Just come to me if it's interesting. Okay, if there's no question, it is 12:08 now. Let's start at 12:20. Yeah?
Okay, yeah, there we are again. I wanted to say this at the beginning, but I forgot. For the assignment 2, there was a typo in the hash for welcome 42. There were actually the hash that I announced was 10855 7908. That was a typo. What there? I typed 55 where it should be a single 5. I have people claiming that it should be 10857876. I can tell you that is wrong. This is the correct hash value. It is. So no worries. This is the correct hash value. So if you don't get to that hash value. Yeah, so the typo was purely that I hit the 5 a bit too often. But that will be a nice exercise. The exercises, the assignment should not be too easy. Let's go back to the presentation, to biometrics. In biometrics, we have to compare the reference features with the probe features. That's what we had on a couple of slides before the break. And so we want to compare, we want to calculate a comparison score between a reference Q and a probe R, and I call that C for comparison between Q and R. So C is some kind of function, and it takes as input a reference template and a probe R, reference Q and a probe R, and then it calculates in some way the comparison. That's a numerical value that it will get. Actually, I can do that in two different ways. Two different flavors. I can calculate a similarity score, or I can calculate a dissimilarity score, or a distance score. A similarity score means that it increases, the comparison score increases with increasing similarity. So the more similar two things are, the higher the score is. A dissimilarity score, or a distance score, is the other way around. The more similar to the Q and R are, the lower that score is. And actually, it doesn't really matter which you use, because you can easily convert one to another. Suppose that I have a dissimilarity score, and I want to turn it into a similarity score. I can just take minus D. Or minus the log of D, or 1 over D, or whatever. I turn a function that decreases with increasing similarity to something that increases. Yeah, that's hopefully easy to see. That's basic mathematics. So I don't care that much. Sometimes I will talk now in the remainder of this lecture about a distance score, a dissimilarity score. Sometimes I will talk about a similarity score. We can do, when we do biometrics, we can do different tests. We have the technology testing. I'll just collect a set of data, and I'll split that data in data to create the probes, and I'll data to create the references, and I'll do comparison there. That will be a specific data collection in a specific room, for example, where there is one or more fingerprint sensors. I can have a scenario testing where I try to simulate the environment. So face recognition, not just in a room with very conditioned lighting, but maybe freely going around. Now it's in the atrium. There is a lot of light. A few minutes ago it was dark. So the light conditions can change, and so we can simulate that in the scenario testing. Or we can have operational testing. An organization is really using the system, and we get some data, some performance data there. So different kinds of tests. Let's look at the biometric processing pipeline. We got that from the ISO picture before, but here is slightly in a different way. We have our biometric characteristics, our fingerprint, for example. And then we capture that on the sensor, and we call it then the biometric sample. So we have this image of the fingerprint in this case. Once we have that, we can extract the features from that biometric sample. And the features are then in. Now I'm talking about enrollment. The features will then be the template, because they will be stored in the database during enrollment. And then I can decide to enroll and store this information in the database or not. In case of authentication, the beginning is all the same, except that I don't call it a template, I call it a probe, and I'll use it for comparison and not for storing. Yeah, that's, but doesn't really matter that much. So what can go wrong? Well, it could be that I can't capture my fingerprint. Yeah, so I put my fingerprint on the sensor, and at the moment that I press the button to capture it, I'll remove it again. Something like that. Yeah, so somehow the system fails in this case to generate an image of my fingerprint. And I'll just start a new attempt, and I'll start all over again until I can capture something. Yeah, that is called a failure to capture. I have my biometric characteristics, and I want to capture that into a biometric sample, and that fails for some reason. But if it succeeds, I just continue in the pipeline, and so I have my biometric sample, but maybe it's of poor quality. Maybe it's face recognition, and there was a lot of light, so my face is completely white. Maybe there was a lot of backlight, and everything is just black. Or whatever, there's something wrong, or maybe I was just moving my head and it's all very vague, or whatever. But from the biometric sample, the system is not able to extract the features that it needs. Okay, we'll just go back to the beginning again and take a new capture. This is the failure to extract the biometric features from the biometric sample. In some cases, we have a failure to enroll. We just can't capture the biometric sample, or it's always of poor quality that the features can't be extracted. That's an error that could also occur. Suppose that I'm doing hard manual labor, my fingerprints will wear off if I'm not using gloves. Yeah, and if my fingerprints get very thin, my finger will get very smooth, it will grow back. Because the inner skin does have the information about my fingerprint and will grow back in exactly the same way. It doesn't grow back in a different way, unless I start cutting it or something like that, but it will grow back in the same way. But because of this poor quality, the sensor will either not be able to capture it every time, or if it captures something, it will determine that now this is low quality and it will not extract the features. And so we could end up in a failure to enroll when we continuously can't go through this particular pipeline. So some of the metrics, then we had a failure to capture in the beginning, FTC. In terms of the ISO harmonized biometric vocabulary, that is the portion of failures of the biometric capture process to produce a captured biometric sample. And that's more or less what I said. And some of them will be, some of these failures will be because I terminated the attempt, or I have insufficient sample quality. Yeah, and if I have those two, the number of occurrences of those two, compared to the total number of capture attempts, so the successful and the unsuccessful, then I can calculate the failure to capture rate. Sorry. If I go to failure to extract, here's the definition. It's not in the harmonized biometric vocabulary, but there's a normal definition. Proportion of the failures of the feature extraction process to generate a template from the captured biometric sample. And so we see how often this extraction process could not create a template, divided by the number of times that I actually called on this particular program. Yeah, so if I address it 100 times and 5 times it goes wrong, doesn't produce anything, it's 5 over 100, 5%. Failure to enroll rate, again, there is an ISO definition of that, but again, I look at the total number of subjects intended to use the system and intended to enroll in the system, and the number of times that I could not enroll a particular person into the system. And the ratio between those, again, is the failure to enroll. This is a typo. Let's mark that.
to extract. Yeah. Have to upload it anyway.
Then what do we have then? We have the failure to acquire rate. That's actually a combination of previous errors. It is, according to ISO, the proportion of a specified set of biometric acquisition process that were failures to acquire. I tried to acquire something, I couldn't. And so it's either a failure to capture, I could not capture the biometric sample from my fingerprint at all, or if I could, I could not extract the features from it, because it was low quality. Yeah, and so I can calculate that, so the number of captures that goes wrong, or if it goes right, so with this probability, then the probability that I can't extract. So this is the failure to acquire. That's just a mathematical concept, for say in that way, to tell me something about how often this system will go wrong. These are more interesting. False match, and on the next slide, false non-match rate. The pipeline that I showed was just for the enrollment process, but I said I can have similar, certainly the top part is similar for when I do authentication or identification. When we do authentication, this is an authentication error. We have the reference, so what's in the database, and we have the probe, which I just made, and I assume that I have features here. I assume that I went through that full process. So now I'm looking at comparing those, calculating the comparison score, either similarity or dissimilarity score. And now I'm looking at the non-mated comparisons. Proportion of the completed biometric non-mated comparisons. Non-mated means that the reference was mine and the probe was yours. So that's a non-mate. If the reference is mine and the probe is mine, those are mated. That resulted in a false match. So my reference and your probe, but still the system said it is a match. Your probe actually was accepted against my reference template. That's a match. It should not have been a match, of course. It's a false match. And probability that occurs is a false match rate. Depends on the imposter scores resulting from the comparison. Imposter score, we talked about comparison score. And actually, comparison score is either a imposter score, when the template and when the reference and the probe are from different persons, or it's a genuine score. Yeah, so if I have the set of all comparison scores, I'll just split it up in two, and I'll say these are the genuine scores. Probe and reference are from the same person, and these are the imposter scores. Probe and reference are from different persons. Yeah, but this is the full set of all comparison scores. Same for the false non-match. I have a probe from a person and the reference from that same person, and they should match. But somehow the system decides that it is a non-match. That's wrong. It should be a match. So it's a false non-match, actually. The system doesn't allow me access based on my own identity. It's false. It's wrong. So it's a false non-match, and the probability that occurs is a false non-match rate. And again, here, we call these comparison scores, we call them genuine scores. That's just a name to have, because a comparison score was a number, and I want to have a label on this number. I want to somehow say this is a genuine score, so it should have a high similarity, either a high similarity score or a low dissimilarity score, or it was an imposter, two different persons, and then the opposite holds. So we have false match and false non-match rate. These are algorithmic errors, error rates. Why? We are just now talking about the algorithm, the matching algorithm. The comparison, I should say the comparison algorithm, according to the vocabulary. It's a comparison algorithm that makes an error. So it's an algorithmic error. Sometimes in literature, or sometimes, very often in literature, you see false accept rate and false reject rate. That's wrong terminology. We'll get to that in a sec. I can influence these rates a bit. I prefer, these are errors, right? I prefer both of them as low as possible. But I can influence them such that I can get one a bit lower, but the cost will be that the other one will go up, or the other way around. I can play a bit with that. Yeah, and at some point, if I play with that such that they have the same value, I call that value the equal error rate. So the equal error rate is just a point where I just played so much that I got these at the same value. And that will say, equal error rate will say something very rudimentary over the performance of the system. Obviously, the lower this equal error rate is, the better the system performs. Yeah, then I managed to get both of them lower. As said, system false accept rate and false reject rate are not algorithmic errors. They are partially depending on the algorithm, but they actually depend on the full system. The fact that I false null match, that I don't get accepted as myself, could be an error of the algorithm. The algorithm looked at my probe, looked at my my reference, and did say it's not from the same person. That is the algorithmic error, the false null match rate. But the whole system could reject me. But that rejection could also be based on the fact that my features, the biometric sample I provided, was of low quality and the features could not be extracted. So actually, it depends on the failure to acquire, which included that failure to extract also. Yeah. So the false reject rate is actually the failure to acquire, in which case I don't get access, right? Plus this. So there are. You can turn one into the you can turn the false accept and false match and false non-match rate into false accept and false reject rate if you have a failure to acquire, if you have that that error rate. Often in literature you see that they talk about false accept, false reject rate, but they don't say anything about this value. They just assume that it's zero or something like that, which is not the case in general. I talked about these scores, genuine scores, imposter scores. And actually I can look at all the values that I see and I can make some distribution of these scores. So what do we have here? This is it for dissimilarity, by the way. Because the genuine scores, if I look at the distribution, those are low values, which I expect for a dissimilarity score, that the genuines are low. And the imposter scores, they have, again, some distribution. I just count them and see in this, there are so many that are of this value, etc., etc. I make this distribution, and And then based on this, at some point, I have to make a decision and say, okay, if I see a score of this and this value, then I have to assume that this is the same person or not. Yeah, there is what we call a threshold, which is here. This is the threshold. And I say if the score, the dissimilarity score in this case, is below that value, below the threshold, I'll just assume that this is the correct person. But if the dissimilarity score is high, more than that threshold, I don't accept that. Which is good because we see that all the imposter scores are high and all the genuine scores are low. But there are some genuine scores which are actually above that threshold. So every time for a genuine score here, I'll make a mistake. That's the mistake I was just talking about, the false non-match rate. Because I'm here, I have a score here, as a genuine person, because that score was too high, that dissimilarity score was too high, I rejected that person. It should have been accepted, it was the correct person. So all of this is the false non-match rate. It's a non-match, but it was from the genuine distribution, so it should have been a match. So it's a false non-match. Yeah, and the note that because this is a distribution, the area under this blue curve or under this blue curve is 1. And so if I calculate how big this area is, that's the false non-match rate. Same for the imposter distribution. There are some imposter scores which are low, below the threshold. And those people will be accepted. And so this area represents the false match rate. Is that clear? Just a simple picture, but a lot to grasp. Here is a bit of the summary of the what we talked about. So we have the failure to capture, failure to extract, which together is the failure to acquire, etc., etc. I will not go too deep into this. Let's see how this works. Again, I did this for dissimilarity score in this case. As a dissimilarity score, the lower the better. And we have, well, now the probes are called test, and the references are called template. So I have five templates, five references of five different persons, and each person provided also a probe. And then obviously if I take the probe of person one and the reference of person one, because I'm looking at dissimilarity score, that should be a small value, 182. But if I compare the probe of person one to the reference of person two, that's an imposter score that I'm calculating. And hopefully this is large, because again, dissimilarity. 588, so this looks good, right? So I have a number of genuine scores here on the diagonal. When I take the probe and the reference of the same person, and all the other ones are imposter scores. That's why I also made here in this picture, this is just a small area. Yeah, and that in that table, there are five values here, and there are 20 values here. Let's assume that the threshold is 225. What does that mean for the false match and the false non-match rate? Let's start with the, let's see, what's on top? Let's start with a false match rate. False match. It's a match? It shouldn't have been a match. It shouldn't have been a match. Oh, that means that we're looking at the imposters. Right? We're looking at the non-diagonal values. And it's only a match if the value is below 225. So how many of these imposter scores are below 225? Yeah, one. This one, right? Yeah. So out of these 20 imposter scores, one is below the threshold. So that means the false match rate is 1 over 20, 5%. What happens if I would, what happens for the false non-match rate? False non-match rate. Oh, it's a non-match, but it should have been a match. Or if it should have been a match, it's related to the genuine scores. Yeah, but so actually I'm interested in the genuine scores that are too high. How many do we see there? Yeah, one. But now, one out of five. Yeah, I've just had five of these and one of them is wrong. So the false non-match rate in this case is 1 over 5, 20%. Now I can start playing with that. What if I increase the threshold? Let me quickly go back two slides. One slide. This slide. I increase the threshold. I'm moving this red line that way. What happens to this green area? It gets smaller. What happens to the false match rate gets smaller. What happens to the now I have twice the false match rate. I have to change this. This is the false non-match rate, of course. What happens to the false match rate? The yellow area. It gets bigger, obviously. Yeah, as said, I can make one smaller at the cost of the other one getting bigger. And you see that here, if I change this threshold, one of these will get smaller while the other one will get larger. And that's what we see what happens. Yeah, so now we made the threshold larger, and I'll just show you these to save some time. The false match rate actually indeed gets bigger, because now there are three of these accepted. So not just this one, but also the other two now. So the false match rate increases to 3 over 20. false non-match rate actually doesn't increase because this is just a small sample. It didn't decrease, but if I would have said 260, yeah, then this would have been gone also. And the other way around, if I would make the threshold smaller, you see that the false match rate actually became smaller from compared to the previous slides, and the false non-match rate gets bigger because now this one is also rejected, the non-match also. So actually, if I just play with this threshold a lot, so here is a threshold, and this is the false non-match rate and the false match rate, and again, this similarity scores in this case, false non-match rate will drop, and the false match rate will go up with increasing thresholds. And you see here, there is a point where these two curves match, and that is where I said the equal error rate, the false match and the false non-match rate are the same. So if I would, by accident, would have picked this exact threshold, false match and false non-match rate would have had the same value. Exactly. What have we done? Actually, we have taken a number of things for granted. We extract features from the template, from the biometric sample to put it in the reference template. The way that I do that, the type of features, the number of features that I'm looking for, that could be done in a different way. The way that I compare, I have an algorithm that gives me this similarity or dissimilarity score. Yeah, I could have another algorithm. Yeah, if you think back where we had overlaid these two minutiae pictures, yeah, maybe I'll look at the real life distance between two points, or maybe I just look at the absolute distance between two points, or whatever. Yeah, I can match them in different ways. So indeed, I have to look at this calculation of the comparison score. That could be a different method. I could have a different I extract a set of features from the biometric sample. I don't have to use all of them. In fingerprint recognition, when we look at the minutiae, actually in the comparison, we forget one of the properties of each minutiae. We just look at the location and the direction of it. A minutiae point has a location, has a direction, and has a type, bifurcation or ridge ending. Actually, I don't look at that. I've decided that this feature will not give me a lot of information and I will get a good performance anyway by just looking at location and direction. What if I would have included that? So what features do I use from the ones that I extract? Feature selection. I can change that. So I can change many things and then get a different performance. This is how we report the performance. So in the previous slide, I had the thresholds against the rates, false match or false non-match rate. Yeah? But in principle, if I go back, I can just pick a threshold, and I'll see what the false match rate and the false non-match rate are, and I can take another threshold and look at what these values are. So for every threshold, I get a pair, false match, false non-match rate. What if I would plot those pairs? So I had a particular threshold and I got this pair, false match rate this much, false non-match rate this much. And I took another threshold, I got another pair, which is there, etc. So I plot false match rate against false non-match rate. The same is information, except I don't know this particular point here, what the threshold is. But in terms of performance, that doesn't really matter. Actually, here is the line X is Y, and where it crosses what is called the DET curve, decision error trade-off curve, that is the equal error point. Yeah? Again, I don't see. I see what the value is. I don't see what the corresponding threshold was. But that's not important. So this is a decision error trade-off curve. This is a receiver operating characteristic curve. It's the same as this one. Can anybody see what happened? I just flipped it. That's all that I did. And so the false match rate is still the false match rate, but the false non-match rate is all of a sudden 1 minus the false non-match rate, which is called the genuine match rate. So I'm now just looking at match rate, false match rate, and genuine match rate.
That's the only difference. It's just a matter of preference. Sometimes you'll see that people use not linear scales but logarithmic scales. Here you see that scales are not exactly the same, are they? This is going from 0 to 1 and this is going from 0 to 0.0, probably also to 1. But I can have logarithmic scales or I can zoom in on part of it. That's not that important. Yeah, so I can just give the equal error rate value as a single value of this is the performance of my system, or I can show it in a curve. If I, as you said, if you want to have the equal error rate down, you have to look at different settings. So this is a dead curve for one setting, and then I look at a different setting and I get another curve, or it could be more towards the origin, could be further away from the origin, and at the very end I pick the one that is closest to the origin. Do I have that here? Yeah, I have that here. I'm not sure if you can see that there are actually four curves here. This is research where we actually looked at gait recognition, where we gave people different shoes, from simple sneakers to heavy walking shoes and then everything in between. So we got, based on just the shoe type, we got bad performance for these two shoes, and then the other shoes gave something which is close together but closer to the origin. So a lower equal error rate value. Just to show that I can, with changing something in the settings, I get a different dead curve, and I can say something about, okay, this system performs worse than this system. I can clearly see that the blue system performs worse than the black system. The red and the black, they are very close together. Yeah, so it's difficult to say something. Let me see if that is in one of the... No, this was the last slide on authentication, so I have to say that now. You have a system, and you want a particular performance of that system. That could be a system where you say, I want very high security. So the false match rate should be as low as possible. This was the false match. False match rate. So this should be as low as possible. So the false match rate should be here. That means that the false non-match rate is high. Okay, I will make sure that none of you get into my system, but the downside is that I have to give my fingerprint a couple of times before I get in. Very secure system. On the other hand, here, the false match rate is high, but the false non-match rate is low. That means a system where whatever I do, every time I give my fingerprint, I get in. Very user-friendly. Yeah, but the cost is that some of you can get in also. Yeah, but this could be access to a high security environment, and this could be access to a computer in an internet cafe. That's okay that somebody else gets in, gets internet time based on my spending. Okay, I'll give you back the money for that. Yeah, if you come and complain. So depending on what your system is used for, yeah, you can choose what your operating point is. Set your threshold based on that. Last few slides are actually on identification, not so much authentication, and we'll also swap in this case to similarity scores instead of dissimilarity scores. Again, this is arbitrary. I could have just turned everything around. Identification, we are looking at failures if an individual I is actually identified as somebody else, not himself. That's a failure in the identification system. I call the bank and I have voice recognition and I say something, and then all of a sudden the system recognizes it as something completely different, somebody completely different, and I get access to his or her account. So here we have it. We have a number of identities and we have all the references of these identities in a database. And what I then do is I'll provide my biometrics again, my biometrics characteristics, for which again the biometric sample is captured and the features are extracted, etc., etc., all the same as before. And we calculate in this particular case again the similarity score. And again, I could do the same for the similarity score, doesn't matter. So between the information I now got and all the references in the database, and I look at when I get the highest similarity. So the person with the highest similarity,
that will provide me the identity. I take my information and I check it with the database. I say it matches best to this reference. So that's the identity I assigned to you. That's in a closed set. There is a difference between closed set and open set identification. In a closed set, I assume that the person at the sensor is actually in my database. So I have to assign an identity to this person. That's up to here. So to here. In an open set identification, anybody could come to that sensor and provide an identity. So I'm still looking for the one providing the highest matching score, but I want that highest matching score also to be a high value. Again, similarly, the higher the better. Yeah. So I want that score also to be above some threshold. So if the highest, if I expect normally, if I have a correct identification, I expect a score of say 100. All of a sudden, somebody comes, provides his biometric data, and we calculate the maximum score to which person does he match best, and that best match will give you a score of 3. Yeah, that's not likely to be the correct person. Yeah, so I want as a quality assurance that best matching score, that it's not just the best, but also at least above some threshold. If it is above that threshold, I'll say, okay, this is you. If not, if the best score is below that threshold, I'll say, okay, the system doesn't know you. So in this case, closed set, I will always get an identity. Open set, I will get an identity, or I will get the system saying, you are not known to the system. Again, errors can be made, obviously. Failure, as I said, a failure is either an individual identified as somebody else, or if you have this open set identification, that somebody from outside is accepted, or somebody from inside is not accepted. And so we make errors there also. In any case, what we do to show the performance of such a system is show what is called a cumulative match characteristic curve, CMC curve. What is the probability, rank one identification, what is the probability that somebody is correctly identified with the highest score in the previous picture? This closed set in this case. Yeah. What is the probability that if I go and present my biometrics, that it matches the best to actually my reference? Maybe it's not the best, but matching it against your template is slightly higher. I came in second place. Well, that's what we call rank. If this value, rank R with N users, if that value is P, means that the probability that my identity is in the first R values, if I would take my probe and I compare it to all the reference templates, there are n reference templates, so I get n scores, and then I rank them, and say, what is the probability that my identity is with the r highest ones? Yeah, if that probability is p, that will tell me something. Obviously, if I have n people, what's the probability that my score is within the n highest? It is there, right? So that will be one. We get a curve like this. Again, three different systems or settings. And if I look at the red one, probability, what is it? 91% probably that my score actually comes up as the highest. And the 96% probability that maybe I'm not the highest, but at least I will be the second highest. Or here I'm actually up to 100% already. So my score, my identity is always among the, 5, 6 highest. This system, the blue system, obviously performs much worse. Yeah, identification means that curve should be as high as possible. Yeah. This is also used in forensics. Yeah. I found a fingerprint of somebody, and I checked it with a huge database of 10 million people. And maybe the fingerprint of the perpetrator is not giving me the highest score, but hopefully he will be within the 10 highest. So I'll take the 10 best scores, and I look at those reference probes, and I'll just manually check that. Visually, they do that. So what you see at CSI, etc., where you have this program running, and then that's not always true. But you knew that. Okay, good. We're 2 minutes over time, and the recording is still running, I hope. So that was all I wanted to say about biometrics. Are there any questions? The way that I store, I repeat it for the people online. What if a biometric database leaks? If that is a face, if there is a fingerprint database and my thumb is in there, I can't use it anymore. I just have 9 fingers left, right? And then it leaks again, and another one leaks. I'm running out of fingers at some point in time. A password we can easily change. But the password is hopefully not stored in plain text. The password is stored as a salted hash. We had that last week. Yeah, then, actually, you can't see my password. I could actually use the same password again. If there's a different salt, you actually can't notice that. There are methods, and we have investigated that here for fingerprints particularly. There are methods to store your biometric reference in such a way that if the database leaks, I'll just log on. I'll just enroll again with the same fingerprint, no problem. If I would enroll twice with the same fingerprint, I could not even match those two together. Still, I can match it against a new probe, and that's that protected reference. I can do the matching. I can't use hashes for that, for example. The cryptographic hashes, of course, that says if there is a bit change in the input, the output is completely different. But we have found ways to work around that. Yeah, but so if it leaks, I'll just throw away the database, no problem. Everybody enrolls again with the same finger, no problem at all. I can do that. Yeah. Also that is also helpful in if I enroll on a campus database here with my fingerprint. And I use the same fingerprint and I go to a nightclub in Oslo and I enroll there. If these two operators would sit together, they could not figure out that it would be me in both databases. If it would be just a normal storage of the template, they could see that, hey, this guy from NTNU Jøvik is also a member of this club. Yeah, with this protected way, you can't think that. Yeah. Other questions? Okay, if not, then there will be exercises in C006, I believe, today. I'm not sure why they have yet another room for us, but it'll be fun. Okay, well, thanks for your attention. If you think this is an interesting topic, I think so, take the technology track, and there are many very interesting master thesis topics available for this area. Yeah? Okay. Continue from last week, the exercises.
There's a C building. If you...
Yeah.